Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at FutureThinkers.org/YouTube. A quick announcement before we start. Mike and I are working on designing some courses, and we'd like to get feedback from you guys on what you'd like to learn from us. So go to futurethinkers.org/courses and fill out our quick survey. It'll really help us out. Enjoy the episode.
Hey guys, today we're going to be talking about deconstruction of identity.
So the reason why we picked this subject is because identity politics seems to be quite a hot topic these days in United States and in other Western countries, where people are trying to put a lot of energy into defending what they perceive to be their identity, whether it's their political leaning, their religion, their gender identity, their sexual orientation, you know, their cultural background, or whatever they think is them. And there's a lot of feelings around it, where people are getting triggered and offended, and it's becoming more and more of a hot subject. So today we wanted to talk about why it would be useful to deconstruct your identity, to disidentify from those things, and how that can be done. And we'll give some examples as well.
I've actually noticed this a lot more in personal conversations too. I mean, we've kind of exiled ourselves, but whenever we go back to the West and just converse with people our age or younger, there is this sort of identification with every label, every kind of background characteristic, like political, class, religion, everything. Like, people seem to grab onto their ideas as if those ideas are internal, as if they're theirs, if they're owned, instead of looking at those things as external objects. And that's what the way I like to think about ideas and about labels, as external objects, so that I can walk around them, look at them, pick them apart. I don't feel guilty about deconstructing them because I'm not them. They're just ideas. They can easily go on the chopping block, right?
Yeah. And so this is the idea of becoming detached from things. Mm-hmm. And detachment doesn't mean that you discard them. It doesn't mean that you are disassociated from things, or that you feel nothing about them, or that see them as not having any value. Not at all. It's more about getting that distance where you observe something as objectively as you possibly can, by looking at it from an outside perspective.
Well, let's talk about that from the emotional perspective then, because why would it be important to get emotional distance from an idea? You know, I feel like it's not necessarily the emotion part that makes it hard to understand the benefit or the history of that idea. It's really the attachment to the result, the end, the ends of the means that gets people tripped up. So let's say you get a lot of kind of your emotional, social, community needs met by identifying as a liberal, because those are all the people that surround you. They're the kind of class you belong to. Maybe at your university or your workplace, people are all kind of identifying as liberal. So the ideas surrounding liberalism are one thing, but then there's all the peripheral benefits that you get from this. And there's this emotional attachment to that label because of all of these other surrounding things. You might even make your income based on this label. So not only is this idea part of your identity, it's something that you now feel like you have to defend, because you are getting a lot of your kind of hierarchy, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, met through this label. And that's something I think is really dangerous, because you're not able to step back and look at that idea objectively.
Yeah.
Now, the attachment to the outcome, I was trying to describe that. And what I mean by that is you want something to be a certain way because you believe it to be true. Mm. So you see the world through the lens of your liberal values, if we want to keep going with this example.
Sure.
And you think of certain things to do with liberalism as inherently right, true, unchallengeable. These are fact. And the rest of the people around you believe the same thing. So you have this attachment to these things being right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And so it might be hard to see it when it's your ideas, and it might be easier to see it first when you look at somebody else's ideas. So, for example, we started watching this show about flat earthers, people who believe that the earth is flat. I can't remember what it's called.
Behind the Curve or
Beyond the Curve or something like that. Yeah. And so, yeah. And so these people are not stupid. They're just average people who have come to believe that the earth is flat. And then what ended up happening is that they become part of this community of other people who believe this.
They get fame and income, recognition, appreciation, everything.
They start hosting conferences on this, and then all of their friends end up being from this group. And so then their whole life revolves around this idea. And then even when they're faced with disproof of this idea being the case, they don't change their mind.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about this, like, why would this be? Well, of course, it's not because of the idea. It's because their whole life depends on it. And if they suddenly rejected this idea, they would lose all of their friends. They would lose their respect and the recognition that they have. You know, some of these people have YouTube channels that are quite popular. They would have to, you know, take that down, or it would be very embarrassing for them. Some people might lose income. It's just, you know, everything would crumble.
I've noticed another interesting thing related to this about the way people perceive the scientific method. And it seemed in that movie, a lot of people, the flat earthers, were working to confirm what they already believed to be true.
Yeah.
So they're constantly searching for evidence. And obviously, with the nature of search engines and search algorithms, what you search for is what you get.
Mm-hmm.
I think the world kind of works this way too. What you think about is what you get. So it's kind of a law of attraction-y kind of thing. But I think this literally is the case for these people. When they go on Google, they search for the confirmation of what they already believe, and they get more of that. So, you know, a whole community, a whole idea, a whole identity is built out of this. And the misinterpretation of the scientific method is exactly that: prove what you believe. The actual scientific method is about disproving your own theory.
Mm-hmm.
So you try, you set up a hypothesis, you set up the conditions for experimentation, and then you try and just hack away at that idea, break it. And you can't do that if you're identified with it, because you feel like you're hacking away at yourself. But if you separate yourself from it, then it becomes this external thing that now needs to stand up by its own merit.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that in the flat earther is a perfect example, but I see this in so many other ways with the way people kind of defend their position or make arguments or debate. It's not about externalizing the idea and then we all work together on opposing sides to cut down that idea. It's really about defending this thing I've identified with.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge problem today. I really can't figure out why it's occurred, because I think it's gotten worse. I don't know about you, but
I have a hypothesis about this.
And all right, let's hack away at that.
So my hypothesis is that the different groups of people that used to be very separate have become all mixed in. And also people have become more vocal about their beliefs. They started wearing them on their shoulder, on their sleeve. And so now everybody's got this badge. I'm this, I'm that. You know, before, let's say, in the 1950s, if you were gay, you probably just kept that to yourself. Now people are like, woohoo, I'm gay. Look at me. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think that society hasn't adjusted yet. We haven't figured out how to interact with each other when we're all so different. Where now the priority is more on individual expression rather than on kind of shutting up and getting along and smoothing out the edges of society.
Yeah, I remember this from school. The kind of our generation, I think, was the beginning of this generation that was now viewing itself as a global civilization rather than a local one.
Yeah.
And suddenly we entered into this competitive landscape where we're not just competing with the other guy my age in my small town. We're competing on a global level. And all of a sudden that the demands of that ratchet up. You know, if you want to go to certain so-and-so prestigious college or university, you need to really compete at an international level to be able to get in. And this has caused us to recognize both the difficulty of that competitive landscape, but also how homogeneous we all are, how similar we all are. and how difficult it is to stand out.
Mm.
And so I think we've also, in noticing that, really worked hard to find our little unique quirks and qualities that we can, you know, grab a flag, put that up in the air and wave around so that people notice us.
So that we stand out. Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I wonder what came first. I kind of suspect that these things co-evolved. This kind of the narrative of diversity and oppression, or like people, different people being differently oppressed, and the actual globalization and the mixing in of different kinds of people.
Right.
So maybe, I know that in certain universities in Canada and in the States, you might be more likely to get in if you come from a minority group or if you've overcome a challenge. So a lot of the times, for example, even when I was applying for university, you had to write an essay about why you deserve to be there. And I remember being coached by my teacher saying like that I should say that I'm an immigrant, like I've worked hard to get here, you know, and to kind of tell that story so that I would be more likely to get in.
Right.
So, you know, to be seen as a kind of minority group.
Right. They didn't really ask you to focus on merit, did they?
No, they did, actually.
They did. Okay.
Yeah.
It sounded like it was like, look at me.
No. It was a lot about merit. It was a lot about grades and what kind of extracurricular activities you did. And, you know, they looked at your quality of your writing as well. So, but also as one of the things they, the teachers who coached me in this suggested that I, you know, I talk about the challenges that I have overcome.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that there's anything wrong with that, but I think that perhaps that is one of the factors that has encouraged people to talk about their identity or gender or whatever as a badge.
Yeah. I studied music for a long time, and I found it really interesting growing up in the 90s, watching the kind of subcategorization of music expand. So I was into metal, and metal when I was a kid was pretty much metal and maybe, you know, death metal and a couple of other subgenres. And then I noticed it just expand and expand, and there was like subgenres of subgenres. And the same thing, my dad also said the same thing was happening with jazz. You know, there were just so many different genres of jazz. So I think the same thing has kind of happened with our group identity, where we have difficulty describing what we are into. So we need to, in order to attract people we want to be with, we need to specify those labels with more detail. And so we end up kind of like chopping up all of these bigger categories into smaller ones. I think what has happened is in doing this to ourselves, we've especially recently discovered that you can subcategorize infinitely.
So I think this actually relates to what you're saying with the globalization. You know, if you're living in a tribe or even in a town of, you know, however many thousand people, you're probably, you know, one of the few gay people or one of the few carpenters or one of the few.
It's a lot easier to stand out in a smaller group.
Yeah, it's easy to stand out. But if you're competing globally or with thousands of other people, then how do you stand out? And so you have to find subcategories.
Right. It's no wonder narcissism has been such a kind of label of our generation. Like when cultures are homogenizing all over the world, when like you can't really say that we have a Canadian or an American culture because it's really very similar. And young people especially, I've noticed when we travel, I mean, you can go anywhere. You can go to Germany, France, Southeast Asia, and you will really find people who are similar to you wherever you go. Mm-hmm. As long as there's cell phones and internet access, we're all sharing the same memes. We're all having similar conversations. We're watching a lot of the same YouTube videos. I mean, I think our generation is really noticing how much we have in common, which is a good thing. But then, going back to a competitive landscape, it's a lot harder to stand out now. So this narcissism is really focused on, you know, what little tiny individual characteristics of the self can I advertise as being a virtue?
Hmm.
And then we have, you know, the phenomenon of Instagram and virtue signaling and, mm-hmm. you know, yeah.
Yeah, it seems that technology has just catalyzed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to say what came first. It seems that these things kind of co-evolved, because obviously these are human characteristics that you want to feel special and different, but at the same time you want to belong. So you're trying to find this balance of like, what kind of label can I find that there's at least a few others of me out there, but not too many?
Yeah, that's right. You want your group, but you don't want them to be too similar. But you do want your like micro subcategorized clique.
Yeah.
I mean, we're thinking of it too. You know, we want our future thinkers community to be, you know, local. Mm-hmm. Come to us in Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why don't we talk about deconstruction and why that would be useful and how that could be done?
Yeah. Okay. So this is something that I've thought about for a lot of years. I think, you know, I brought up exile at the beginning of this conversation. I feel like around the time of being 18, I left home and I kind of entered into this exile that I've never really returned from. I left home, I went to Vancouver and I started college and, you know, that sort of thing. And along the way through this isolation, I've really picked up a lot of books about the mind, about spirituality, about psychology. As well, I had a lot of time to just sit and think. And one of the things I uncovered, and I can't remember exactly what book it was from, but it was the Buddhist concept of detaching yourself from your attachments. So, and I think the basis of this is that you're looking to stop suffering, put an end to suffering. And attachment to results is what brings suffering, because you cannot guarantee a result. You want something, and it may or may not happen. It might be a 50-50 chance, or it might be less. So you end up, by wanting things, setting yourself up for disappointment. Plus, we live in a world where everything decays, everything dies. It doesn't matter what you want, it all returns to dust. All of the monopoly money goes back in the box. So we tend to forget that and set ourselves up for massive disappointment by forgetting that mom and dad will die. It's funny I even said might. No, they will die, and so will you. So, you know, in my investigation of my own mind and in reading these books, I came across this idea of detaching from your ideas of identity and self. Kind of early on. And one of the ways I like to do that is to visualize my ideas as objects, because I'm kind of a machine, you know, kind of thinker. Like, I like to think about how things work and break them apart into their components. So I imagine ideas as objects, and then I take them apart and I figure out if the individual parts work on their own. If they do, I take them away, I put them over here in my little briefcase or backpack, and I take them with me. But I also remember that they're not part of me. Every single object has a do not ingest sign on it. It's in my backpack, but I can set it down at any time. So I'm curious to know, because I know you've come across this same insight somehow, how did you come across it? Because I can't really remember. I just know that there's like this long investigative period, and then it became the new operating system of how my mind worked. I stopped identifying with anything, labels, ideas, anything. And everything was subject to discrimination, chopping, deconstruction, you know, any idea of myself. So how about you? Where does this come from for you?
I guess I just was always curious about how people worked, because I grew up in a, you know, in a time that was kind of strange, and things weren't clear, weren't stable, both in kind of in the world, in the country that I grew up in Russia. You know, there were some issues in my family too that I couldn't understand as a child. And so from an early age, I really wanted to understand how things work, how people work, why things are the way they are. So I was also a loner and spent a lot of time out in nature contemplating things, and then went and studied psychology. And but actually, I didn't start practicing meditation until my mid-20s. I did a lot of contemplation, but it was unstructured. I didn't have a teacher or a framework, or I hadn't read any books about it. So it was just kind of thinking about how things are.
So there's no specific period that stands out to you where this insight was grasped?
There's when I was around 19, I had an experience where my view of the world kind of broke. But it wasn't an insight about myself, my sense of self or identity. It was about the world. And it in part had to do with psychedelics, but also just with my own kind of developmental process, where I realized that things are not what they seem in the world. And that there's, it's kind of the same insight as, you know, the Matrix, that the world is kind of a projection. It's not real in any solid sense. But I didn't at the same time have an insight about myself also being a construction and not really being real. So I had that insight in my early 30s. So there was over a decade gap between those two. And it was a very uncomfortable time, actually, because I still hold on to ideas about myself and what I was, while still kind of looking out at the world and being like, none of this is real. Mm-hmm. So it was a very nihilistic part of my life, and kind of depressed and not very happy. But the insight about myself being a construction I had in my early 30s through doing meditation. I started doing meditation when I was, I think, around 25. And I did a lot of it for a couple of years in my early 30s. And this insight was a result of that.
Right.
So it was slightly different than what you're describing, because I didn't, at least at the start of it, I didn't consciously kind of try to hack away at ideas and dismantle them. It was more experiential, where I would just go into these deep meditative states and try to observe different processes in my mind, how different feelings would arise and subside. And then just through that, I realized that, well, how can it be that the observer and the thing being observed are like, how is it that they're the same thing? They can't be. If something is observing and something is being observed, they have to be separate.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I realized that those things were not me.
Mm.
And then I just kept zooming in further and further into those things. It felt like, you know, so for example, if I was observing anger arising and subsiding, then I would zoom into that. So, okay, well, what am I actually feeling? Well, first, there's kind of a rush of blood to my face. And then there's a tingling. And then there's this kind of clenching in my solar plexus. And then my heart starts beating faster. And then my palms start sweating. And then so I would kind of deconstruct it into those sensations. And then I would deconstruct each sensation even deeper. Like, okay, so how does it start? How does like the sensation in my solar plexus, how does it progress? And then I zoomed in all the way until like just tiny vibrations, what it felt like vibrations, or like a wave of something rises and subsides. It's like this vibratory function.
Related to this, I think I find the concept of state-dependent memory to be really interesting, because it's almost like you have different identities based off of the emotions that you're feeling, different kind of points of view, different memories. Everything changes when you're in a different emotional state. So when you brought up the feeling of anger, I know that what goes along with that are certain memories of what make you angry, or certain sort of habitual patterns. When someone makes you angry, you might recognize this in another experience from your past and kind of reactivate the same behavior, the same responses. You know, you definitely notice it when you go home to visit family. You kind of fall back into your old rehearsed childhood responses. I think this sort of detachment from the idea helps to uncover what that state-dependent memory is and to get distance from it. So like you were analyzing the different feelings in your body of anger, you also, if you are allowing that anger to be a separate thing, you're also able to get distance from it and watch the memories come in too, mm-hmm. and not identify with the memories. And then that's when you really go through the process of deconstructing your unconscious habits.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you can, you know, if you've got that little bit of elevated perspective, and I am not angry. My body is experiencing anger.
Yeah.
You know, then, yeah, then you can start to deconstruct it and undo that pattern.
Yeah. And yeah, totally. I did the same thing with my thoughts, where I watched the thoughts arise and subside and how they morph and change. And actually, this method of taking ideas and picking them apart, especially certain ideas that I really held on to, I kind of did that last, which is, I don't know if that's the supposed order, but that was my path. And so, for example, the idea of authority, I had attachment to authority, like that certain people's opinion is more valuable than others. And that, or that, you know, somebody's opinion could be untouchable.
Yeah. yeah, that's dangerous.
Yeah, totally. But I was just not really aware of it until I picked it apart and realized how ridiculous it was. That, you know, all of these monkeys basically are going around flapping their meat flaps and sound comes out.
You mean their mouths,
their
right?
Mouths,
not
yeah.
The other meat flaps.
Oh, God, the image.
I've been grossing you out all day today.
You Sorry have been. That. Oh, God. Yeah, you know, they're just like making sound with their mouth, and somehow that sound is more valuable than sound that comes out of other monkeys' mouths.
I wanted to look at different ways. Actually, let's think about the different things that can be deconstructed. So we've talked about ideas, but I think the way I think about ideas is kind of a broad, in a very broad way. So the idea of I am a human.
Yeah, I love that one.
The idea of an emotion that I'm experiencing, or yeah. I am male, or I am straight, or I am like any of these different things, or I have arms and legs, or I am this body, I am this brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's really fun to do that kind of questioning down to the center of reality, you know, like, well, okay, what if I'm human? What makes up a human? What is a human? Let's just try it.
Yeah.
Answer the question.
Yeah. This is a really fun one to deconstruct.
Yeah.
So, okay. So what would most people say is a human? So it's, you know, this type of, you know, it looks like this. It's a body with arms and legs and a head and a brain. And maybe you would say, oh, it's because the genes are human rather than, say, monkey. Or maybe you say, well, it's the soul that makes a human.
Well, let's step away from soul for a sec. Let's just talk about the physical characteristics of okay. I am human. So what do you consider yourself, what do you consider I to be? For me, I consider it to be the consciousness. Well, is that my brain? Is that thinking? Well, if I'm asleep, am I not I? If I'm unconscious, if I get hit in the head, am I not I? I would say, no, you're not. But you can still look at my body, my unconscious body, and say, well, that's a human.
Mm-hmm.
But I am not I if I'm unconscious. So I must not be the human that is unconscious. Okay, well, what if you cut all my arms and legs off? So if you look for the definition of human, I'm this armless, legless body, but that's not the definition of human. Humans, by definition, do have arms and legs. So am I no longer human at that point? You would say, well, you're a human minus arms and legs. Okay, let's go a step further. What if you cut off my head and kept my head artificially alive?
Separately from the body.
Yeah.
Like which
and you
of
kept
those...
the body alive too.
Yeah.
Which one of them is me? Okay, well, you can probably narrow it down. I am my brain then. Okay. Well, if I...
What if you cut off the brain in
yeah,
half?
Yeah. What part of the brain am I? I mean, there's that whole experiment with split brain patients where to stop the cascading of seizures across the brain, surgeons will go in and slice the connection between the two hemispheres of the brain, disconnecting them and thereby creating two separate, unique personalities. When that see, I think it's something like something sees and something thinks in language.
Yeah, yeah.
So when they ask, you know, they do a comparison showing an image or two different images to the two different eyes because the eyes are operated by different sides of the brain. the hand might write out, I saw a duck. And you might say to the researcher, I saw a dog. Mm-hmm. And because you saw both.
Yeah.
With the two eyes. So, okay. So back to the question. Which side of the brain am I? Am I the conscious one that can reason and think? Or am I the unconscious one? If they're connected, how much of me is unconscious? How much of me is conscious?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or you could say like, if the person is in a coma, are they human?
Yeah.
If they're not only not conscious, they're not responding at all.
So it seems like when you say something is human, you're describing a collection of consciousness and body.
Consciousnesses also, because different parts of the brain generate different sensations.
Yeah. So you have different, this has been proven too, you have different personalities in different areas of the brain as they're activated. Mm-hmm. And that's where state-dependent memory comes in. I have a personality of an angry person when I'm angry, and that personality subsides when I'm not angry.
Yeah.
So that person might have completely different leanings, values, a completely different personality than me eating ice cream. Those two, just like, this guy's like, it's a great day out. It's so nice out. I love people. And the other one's like, I want to kill all of you. They don't have the same opinions. So which one am I?
Mm-hmm.
Again, very challenging. So,
and also over your lifetime, you change. You progress.
Right, and your individual cells are replaced every 4 years. Yeah. That's another thing. So, okay, I am not specifically a human. I am a consciousness occupying a human. Would that be more accurate to say?
But then you could also even deconstruct that you are your consciousness, because when you're in a coma, are you still you? Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah.
So all you can say at the end of the day is I am. That's the only accurate statement that you could say about yourself.
Yes. Everything you kind of gave away the end. you gave them the answer.
I gave the trade away.
But I mean, the I am aspect, the thing, I don't know what you call that, but it is talked about in the Bible. It's talked about in Buddhism. It's talked about in Hinduism. Yeah. It's like this. The only thing that you can guarantee in the world is I am. Everything else falls away under a certain amount of scrutiny.
Yeah.
And then you enter into the realm of, say, quantum physics and the double slit experiment, the particle wave collapse. You should really just Google this if you don't know about the double slit experiment. But essentially, matter only exists if you are looking at it, and otherwise it somehow behaves as a wave.
It's probabilistic, yeah.
Yeah, a probability field. Mm-hmm. And this has been proven through the double slit experiment. Please Google it. It will blow your mind if you haven't heard of this already.
Mm-hmm.
So you can break down all of matter and reality. Does this exist? Well, apparently yes when I'm looking at it. Apparently not when I'm not looking at it.
Yeah.
That's a whole other mind fuck. Yeah. But okay, so back to identity.
Yeah.
What can you say you are? And what is practical to say you are?
So what you said about, obviously, if you just say I am, okay, and everything else is a construction of some sort, or it falls away under certain circumstances, is that actually useful? So here's the thing. In developmental psychology, this is not just a spiritual concept, actually. In developmental psychology, for example, Keegan's model of adult development, that is the fifth stage of development. That's the final stage of adult development, is where the only thing that you're identifying with is, well, I am, basically nothing else.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean, I am? I exist.
I exist.
I perceive.
Yeah. As far as I can tell, I exist. I can't remember what the exact quote is, but something I don't know what is perceiving I don't know what, or I'm misquoting it. But
notice what's absent in that statement of I am. It's not I think.
No. So I think, therefore I am is an incomplete deconstruction.
Yes. Yeah. So I am not my thoughts.
No.
My thoughts are things that happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that one interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So I find this is another thing that's really interesting when you talk to people who haven't done this kind of like deep introspection about their own identity, is they really end up identifying with thoughts.
Yeah.
I am this because I have had these thoughts.
Yeah. And this can happen to really, really highly intelligent people.
Yeah. Okay, so let's look for the utility in temporarily putting your ideas in a backpack and taking them with you, and the ability to set them down if you see fit.
So that's kind of the difference between your skin and your clothing. Your skin is part of you, your clothing you wear, but then you take it off when you go into the shower.
Right. So why would you want to disidentify with certain values that are, in your mind, perfectly reasonable to have, super valuable, good, considered to be virtues, such as I am not a thief, I will not steal mm-hmm. from you. So why would it be a good thing to be able to set down, I do not steal?
Go ahead.
My family is starving.
Yeah.
I have no access to money. I have to steal to feed my family.
Yeah. Yeah. I've deconstructed actually the idea of I'm a good person.
I'm a good person. Okay.
I'm a good person. Yeah. Because, well, okay, so what is good for one person may not be good for another person.
Yeah.
And also ideas of what a good person is are not necessarily universal.
Yeah, what makes up a good person? I do not do harm to other beings?
Yeah.
What
if you accidentally...
Your existence is death.
Exactly.
Krishna put it. Like you...
Life?
By living, you are affecting death on everything around you. Every vegetable you eat, every step you take kills billions of bacteria.
Yeah.
I mean, your life is inflicting death.
Exactly. Life subsists on life.
Mm-hmm.
By definition. It can't be any other way.
So the statement, if based on that definition, I am good, is false for everyone.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what's a different way to define I am good?
Well, it could be that you treat other people in a way that you perceive to be good. But nobody treats everybody equally. Generally, people might treat those that they know or respect well, but then people that they view as outsiders or somebody in another part of the globe, they might not care about or not treat well.
What if I'm a masochist? How should you treat me?
Yeah, what if you want me to beat you up?
Yeah. What if my culture or religion requires me to harm others, harm and or convert others?
Exactly. What if that's considered to be good deeds, you know? And that's actually... in tribal societies, being a good warrior would be considered to be a good person. And being a good warrior is measured in how many people you've killed.
Hmm.
So good and evil are very relative. And I know that this is a very dangerous statement to make because it doesn't mean that it doesn't matter. Here's the thing. So after I've disidentified with all of these different things, I was in a state of nihilism.
Yeah.
So nothing matters. Yeah. And it's
everything
all
sucks. Everyone's evil.
Yeah. And nothing matters. And we're all just, horrible beings consuming everything that is alive.
But you still see the attachments in that, right?
Yeah.
So we are horrible beings is still an idea that you're identified with.
Yeah.
What makes us horrible by existing?
Totally. Yeah. And then, so that was a transitionary stage. And then I got past that where I was able to see the multiplicity, kind of the paradox of all of these different things existing and not existing simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And that everything just is. Not only I am, but everything else also just is.
So let's talk about getting comfortable with contradiction.
Yeah.
Okay, well, why is that important? To have two conflicting ideas. To be comfortable with.
Because, well, I will just say from my own perspective, I don't know if I can find a different answer right now. But so the more I investigated, the more I realized that things just aren't solid anywhere. Like no idea is good enough to encapsulate every possible scenario or to answer every question. And it was necessary to have multiple frameworks and multiple ideas, and a lot of the time they were contradictory.
There's also this attachment and desire to have a binary answer.
To figure it out.
Yeah, to figure it out.
Yeah.
And some things, I actually, from my way of thinking and background, I hate the statement that some things are unknowable. I hate that statement because it kind of is demotivating to go figure out the unknowable.
Really? For me, it's like the mystery. It's so exciting. It's fascinating.
Well, I want to figure out how things work. So, right. But someone telling me that that's unknowable, don't bother, is like, ah, fuck that. I want to figure it out anyway. I want to try anyway. But I think it's very important to, for the sake of reducing suffering, to not require the result. To not require that one theory be proven right and another be proven wrong, or to have a binary answer for any given situation. Like, this group of people is right, this group of people is wrong, and there's no middle ground. There's no gradient between them. I think that one fucks us up a lot as a society, that we need an answer.
Yeah.
Because both sides can be right, and both sides have their own complexities and ways of being right and wrong.
Yeah.
And unless you can sit there and look at the contradiction and be comfortable with it and just accept that it exists, then the actions taken out of that necessity and attachment to the binary tend to be violent, coercive.
Yeah, or you try to convert people to your point of view, for example.
Yeah, or they just don't go anywhere near the actual solution, the workable solution for the problem.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I tend to be like very binary about the way I'm in daily life, like especially because I'm a systems person. So I want the formula to produce the result, and if it doesn't, then I got to tweak the formula. But it doesn't always work that way. Especially when people enter in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
People are not rational.
Yeah. No, they are not. All right. Anything else we want to talk about? I'm not sure that we've really like wrapped this up in a bow.
Well, maybe the desire to wrap it up in a bow.
Yeah. The shit.
Completionist nature.
Yeah. Okay. Well, to find the true answer, we've made a course.
Oh, God.
There is no transfer. But we have made a course, so you can go check that out at courses.futurethinkers.org. I love pitching. Buy it now. All right. That's it. Show notes will be at the end of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
If you have questions or comments or you want to join the discussion for this this topic, you can go to our Discord channel. That would be at futurethinkers.org/Discord. Yeah. Cool. We encourage you guys to go join that. Oh, yeah. And we are officially taking orders for the course on Monday.
Yeah. What date is that?
It's probably the 11th. It's a Monday. Go check it out. We're only going to be accepting the first 20 people for the course who sign up. So, yeah.
This is going to be the test run of the course.
Yeah.
And then we're going to close it. And then take feedback and then do a public launch.
Yeah. And the public launch will be a higher price. So there's kind of a reason for you to want to get in on the beta.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Adapt to the Future PDF is also available at the same URL. Or if you just go to futurethinkers.org, there'll be a little pop-up. You can sign up. Basically, it is figuring out ways to adapt to our changing future. And it kind of covers some of the basics of what we're actually going to talk about in more detail in the course.
Yeah. And the first course is called The Ancient Art of Adulting. And so that's about kind of the developing mentally to become more mature.
Yep.
And that includes a bunch of the ideas that we've talked about on the podcast, like sovereignty, deconstructing narratives, deconstructing your identity, and a bunch of other things.
Archetypes,
Maslow's hierarchy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. We'll see you in the next one.
Yeah. See you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for tuning in to Future Thinkers. For all the books, resources, and mentions from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/89. And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord. Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.
This episode is brought to you by Qualia, a nootropic supplement that helps support mental performance and mood. To get 10% off, use the code FUTURE at checkout. And to learn more about neurohacking, visit futurethinkers.org/neuro.